Good morning, everybody. Hope you're doing well. It's Steph. Got a question. I won't read it in great detail about the origins of feminism. And yeah, we'll talk about that. But I do want to talk in general about ideologies as a whole, of which feminism is one. There's no such thing as philosophyism. There's just philosophy, right? So isms are there to keep you from reaching adulthood. Because if you stay in a state of relative childhood, then what happens is you're easy to control because you're easy you stay in an immature mindset. So all ideologies fundamentally exist to keep you in a state of perpetual childhood or adolescence. And the way they do that is to lure you into staying in a mindset of being utterly subject to external factors, right? So when you become an adult, you take 100% self-ownership. You recognize that there are external factors and you learn to work with them or around them and so on, right? So when you become an adult, you take 100% responsibility for your own self and your own life. Now, what ideologies do, though, is they lure you into thinking that there are external factors that dominate your existence. And if they can get you to believe that external factors dominate your existence, then they keep you in a state of perpetual childhood because that's your childhood. When you're a child, external factors do dominate your existence. I mean, the family that you're born into, you don't have any control over. The family you stay with, you don't have any control over. The income of your parents, whether they get along well, whether they do well or they do badly in their habits, whether they fight or get along, all of these things are beyond your control. Socioeconomic status and all of that. So all of these things are beyond your control. And it would be unhealthy if you're in a negative situation, you're in an abusive or destructive situation at home, it would be unhealthy in the long run to take ownership for that. Right? I mean, there's a Zach Galifianakis Between Two Ferns with, was it Brie Larson or something like that? So your parents divorced when you were younger, is that your fault? You know, it's kind of like a joke, right? Well, no wonder they had problems. They named their child after a piece of cheese. So it's unhealthy to take 100% ownership for the life that you have as a child. And you know, part of maturing is recognizing that you were not responsible as a child, but you are responsible as an adult. You are not responsible as a child, but you are responsible as an adult. And that process of understanding that is a process of philosophical self-knowledge and basic acceptance and understanding of reality. Ideology, on the other hand, seeks to say that you are responsible for what you're not responsible for, and you're not responsible for what you are responsible for. So it reverses that. Ideology keeps you then in a state of perpetual childhood. That is, it makes you easy to manipulate and easy to control and easy to bully and also easy to enrage, because helplessness, giving you the perception of helplessness, is a precursor to focusing your rage, because helplessness and rage live next door to each other, because they're both extremes of the fight and flight mechanism, and you activate one and you activate the other. If you provoke rage, you also provoke helplessness, and if you provoke helplessness, you also provoke rage. So you become malleable, easy to control, an ultimate conformist, and you generate, an ideology generates within you the helplessness that in turn generates the rage, which ideology can focus on, I mean, the enemies of those in power. So just to give you sort of a more tangible example, if you look at something like communism says that your personality, your being, is defined by your relationship to the means of production, right? So if you own the means of production, you have one moral nature and personality type. And if you don't own the means of production, then you have another kind of personality or mental structure or type. And of course, the middle class is a big problem, right? There shouldn't really be a middle class in communism because there wasn't much of a middle class when communism was first developed. And so this is one of the reasons why communism hates and always seeks to slaughter the petty bourgeoisie, the shop owners, the small capitalists, and so on, because the small capitalists are the lubrication between the poor and the wealthy, right? Because if you're poor, then you can choose to open a shop, you can choose to open a small factory, you can choose to open a small plumbing business or key cutting business or ice selling business or something like that, which means you own the means of production and therefore you can get out of being poor. And so social mobility is anathema to the communist worldview, which is why they have a peculiar hatred. It's not peculiar when you understand the ideology. You have this peculiar hatred. They have this peculiar hatred for the bourgeoisie, because the bourgeoisie is a transitional object between wealth and poverty. So, and it's both ways, right? So the poor can become wealthy by becoming minor capitalists, and sometimes the wealthy end up becoming minor capitalists because they've lost their money, right? And if the wealthy lose their money and fall down into the bourgeoisie, that's against the theory of communism, which is that your control of the means of production is foundational to your identity. Well, what happens if you do badly in business or something happens and you lose your control over the means of production, at least the major means of production? Well, you end up with a little repair shop. I mean, I remember reading once about some of the most famous glass makers, and in particular stained glass makers of the 1930s, and Art Deco was the rage, and so on. In the late 1920s and the 1930s, there was an entire family, the brothers of which were famous for their stained glass work. And then for various reasons, the business fell out of favor and there was infighting among the brothers. And one of them ended up running a small repair shop for the last 15, 20 years of his life. So they had gone from owning major factories to he had a small repair shop, I assume, associated with glass, but a small repair shop for 15, 20 years at the end of his life. So he'd fallen from a major capitalist to a petty bourgeois, and that's against the theory, right? That's against the theory. The theory is that once you control the major means of production, you can exploit the workers and therefore should never become poor. If you become relatively poor, that's against the theory. So they hate the bourgeoisie and have to eliminate it in order to preserve the theory. So communism says that you are responsible for where you're born, but you're not responsible for your life as an adult, right? I like this is really important to understand. Sorry, I just really want to emphasize this. So communism says that you are responsible for where you're born. In other words, if you're the child of a capitalist, you're also to be blamed. And if you're the child of a worker, a proletariat, then you are to be praised. And we know this because when the communists murdered the bourgeois families, as they did on a depressingly regular basis and do, they killed the children too. I mean, they didn't spare the children of the Romanovs, saying, well, it's not your fault, it's not your responsibility, it's not your issue. They didn't do any of that, right? They just killed them all, and they sort of do this on a regular basis. So they say you are responsible for where you're born. You're just not responsible for what happens to you as an adult, which of course is the complete inversion of reality. You are not responsible for where you're born, but you are responsible for what you do as an adult, right? So that inversion is very tempting to people. It's very tempting to people. If, let's say, you're born to drunken, embattled, warring parents, and therefore, as a result of that, your family is poor, or your father is irresponsible and lazy, and therefore keeps getting fired, and therefore you end up being poor, well, you would have some criticism of your parents regarding that, right? Regarding that situation. But if you say, well, no, it's the class structure, it's this, that, or the other, your parents aren't responsible, they're trapped in the cycle of the relationship to the means of production, and they can't be held accountable or responsible for anything, then you can't blame your parents. On the other hand, though, if you're born a capitalist, I guess your parents are bad by nature, and you are bad by nature just because of where you're born. So what you're selling is a lack of responsibility for your adherents and total responsibility for your enemies. And really, this is the cycle of abuse, right? This is what abusive parents do, is they say, well, you as a 7 or 8 year old, you are totally responsible for what you do. But as a grown adult, my actions are determined by your behavior. I am not responsible. So you are self-causal. You have free will. I'm just dominoes or a shadow that depends entirely upon your behavior, right? So I was talking to a fellow yesterday whose mother, I mean, basically said this very explicitly. She said, I had to hit you because you were bad. You made me hit you, right? So you, as a 7-year-old, were bad. You had full choice, full free will. But I, as an adult, had no choice and no free will, and you forced me to hit you. I had no choice about hitting you because you were bad. So me hitting you is an effect of the cause of you being, quote, bad. You have full moral responsibility both for the bad actions that you did and the resulting hitting that I did. Again, all isms invert that. What they sell is eternal childhood to those who want to avoid growing up. And it becomes self-feeding, right? So, of course, if you say to someone you have no chance to become wealthy because you're not born with control over the means of production, and then they end up accepting that, then they end up with continued wealth and dysfunction because they never say, well, I guess if I want more money and more control, I should go and start a business. They say, well, no, you can't do that because the bourgeois are evil and you weren't born close to the means of production, and therefore you can't get ahead. Then they don't get ahead, and deep down, they recognize that they sold out their potential for ideology, and ideology is all about crushing your potential. And that way, you have the ideology peddlers, the ideologues, those in power, have a huge number of people who are both crippled and resentful that they can then point at their enemies, and all of that frustration can be taken out. Like, of course, one of the reasons why the communists disliked me, other than my ideology, was that I was born into a ridiculously poor household and yet made something of myself by, I mean, I suppose controlling the means of production, right? I mean, I did that with regards to being a software entrepreneur and all of that. And then I did that controlling the means of production being, you know, this microphone and the cameras and all of that. And so I was not just theoretically, but in terms of practicality, I was a repudiation of the theory. So ideology seeks to make you a perpetual child so that you can be crippled, thwarted, feel helpless, and then your rage can be harvested to be used against the enemies of those in power. So if we look at something like feminism, how does this play? Well, my theory is that feminism will say you are responsible for the circumstances of your birth, but you're not responsible for your adult life. And they say this to the victims, right? And the perpetrators are always considered responsible both. It's kind of funny because the perpetrators are considered responsible both for the circumstances of their birth and for everything they do as adults. Except there's a kind of determinism to ideology that says, as a man, you're going to be a patriarch. You're born into a patriarchy. As a man, you are a patriarch. You're going to be a patriarch. You're going to have these particular views of women. It's determined. But at the same time, they say it is predetermined and it is evil, right? And this is the same thing with communism. They say that your mindset is based upon your relationship to the means of production, and also for your enemies, they're 100% responsible. So for you, as the poor benighted proletariat, you're not responsible for your life and your mindset because you're just born without owning the means of production. But as a capitalist, you also have the same kind of mindset, causality, right? Because you're born owning the means of production. And you, though, are 100% responsible for your mindset. So those who don't own the means of production are not responsible for their mindset. But those who own the means of production both are and are not, right, responsible for their mindset. Because if we say that mindset is determined by X factor, it could be racial, it could be class, it could be sex, it could be any number in relation to the means of production, it could be economic. So if we say you're helpless in the face of these larger forces, then we should not hold people responsible, right? We don't blame a lion for being hungry because that's determined by hunger hormones and instinct and so on, right? So if we say your mindset is 100% determined by external forces, then we should not hold that person morally responsible. If we're going to say mindset is determined by sex, race, by relationship to the means of production, you name it, then we should not hold people responsible. Then your mindset is just a shadow cast by the object called determinism. But then the problem is, of course, if you hold the ideology to its logical structure and say, well, look, if I happen to be born to a family that owns the means of production, I'm not responsible for my resulting mindset, well, then you can't blame anyone for anything. You can't hold anyone accountable. You can't say that's wrong. Like, you can't say it's physics and also it's wrong, right? If you say a rock bounces down a hill, that's physics. You can't also say it's immoral for a rock to bounce down a hill, like the rock is morally wrong. So when you dial up determinism, you dial down morality. But what ideology does is it dials up determinism and then it dials up morality at the same time, but only for the enemies. But only for the enemies. You know, if it requires a violent, bloody revolution to change the ownership of the means of production, and that's the only way that that mindset can change, well, then people should not be responsible for their mindset prior to that, right? Because it takes so much violence and effort to change that mindset. Therefore, individuals are not capable of it. Therefore, we should not punish them for that which is beyond their ability to control, right? And people want that eternal childhood. They do. Or to put it another way, which I think is more accurate or deeper, abusive parents want you to stay in a state of eternal childhood in many ways, because if you become an adult, then the limitations of your upbringing become clear to you. So when I first got into the business world, I didn't know what to do. I remember giving a presentation at a major Canadian financial institution, and I finished the presentation. I didn't know whether to sit down. And one of my business partners had to write me a note saying, sit down. I didn't know. And part of the business world, of course, is socializing. And I didn't know how to socialize with really competent people. And so as I moved out of poverty and into the middle class, the bad parenting I had received became enormously clear to me. And it's one of the things that kind of got me mad at my parents, was how badly prepared I was for any life of any kind of success. So your parents want you to stay in trash world because then you'll never judge them from any other perspective. So ideology serves the needs of the parents by telling you you can't succeed, because if you begin to succeed, the awfulness of your parenting will become clear, if that was the case, right? How bad your parenting is will become clear, and probably still is. So ideology serves that need. It also serves the need of the child to not criticize the parents, right? So if you are kind of crippled, as I was, I mean, I was kind of crippled when I was early on in the business world. I was kind of crippled. I didn't know how to act. I didn't know how to behave. I didn't know how to talk to people or what to talk about. And also, in particular, because I was not much of a sports guy, I couldn't talk about sports because I'm okay with small talk, but for me, it's like being a pearl diver. I can go down, but I can't stay down. So what do you talk about? Learning how to have easy conversations because people are looking for social skills, right? And the reason why social life is important in the business world is people are looking for social skills because a lot of your success in business has to do with social skills. And that isn't just like, can you play golf with people? It's, do they like you? Will you be able to negotiate and navigate conflicts? You know, are you going to end up pissing people off to the point where they drag you down in some horrifying scimitars of legal action or something? Like, will you succeed? Do you have confidence? And do people like you? Because if people like you, they'll work with you. And if there are conflicts, they'll deal with those. If they don't like you, things tend to escalate to the point where your business often can't survive, right? So they're looking for conviviality. They're looking for, as the young folks say, riz, right? They're looking for all these sorts of things. So selling perpetual childhood is big business. Selling perpetual childhood is big business. I mean, there are so many contradictions in it. Of course, it's ridiculous, but selling perpetual childhood is big business. And it serves everyone but the victim. Serves those in power, serves abusive parents, serves... I mean, the other thing that happens when you go from poor to middle class is you also recognize the unbelievable deficiencies in your government education, right? So you learn just how incredibly pathetic your teachers were. Right? This is really, really important to understand. When you start actually building something and doing something real and of economic value in your life, you realize just what unbelievable losers your parents, but definitely your teachers. Because, of course, your teachers lorded it all over you because you didn't learn some triangle inequality relation, because you didn't learn some useless geography fact, because you didn't learn the technical definition of photosynthesis, because you couldn't genuinely explicate the difference between mitosis and meiosis, like all of this stuff that I still have intellectual scar tissue from like 40 years later. So your teachers would roll scorn upon you because you didn't know all of this useless crap that they were forcing you to regurgitate as the most important knowledge of the known universe. Because teachers aren't sitting there saying to you, well, you know, this is useless garbage that's never going to make you a penny, and the opportunity costs of everything you're not learning are going to be staggering and prodigious, but this is on the curriculum. The curriculum blows intergalactic chunks. It's a rainbow yawn. It's a driving the big white bus to eternity and infinity. So all of this stuff blows, but I have to teach it to you, and I hate the curriculum. It's completely useless. It's counterproductive because it's giving in you a genuine fear and loathing of learning. But I have to do it because I want a paycheck, and I'm totally willing to sell out your intellectual future for the sake of easy money and summers off, right? So your teachers, they're not going to say that, right? So your teachers have to give you the illusion that there's anything important in what they're teaching. And I think the studies are 97, 98% of the stuff you study for 12 years straight in school, you never ever use again. And it's garbage. And, you know, it's something that I have to veer away from intellectually. I don't veer away from a lot intellectually, but when I think of the thousands and thousands of hours that I spent being bored and learning useless trivia in order to jump through hoops and get out of high school, it's incredibly painful to me. Just what could have been taught, how interesting it could have been, how enjoyable it could have been, how deep and rich and meaningful it could have been, except for the trash teachers. Now, I guess there's a curriculum, there's a whole system. I get all of that, and there's people who support it and all of that, but when you get into the real world and you start having to do real things of real economic value, you realize that your teachers, almost all, were just losers hiding out from the real world and indoctrinating children. It used to, at least when I was a kid, it was useless. Now it's actively toxic and dangerous, right? The stuff they're teaching the kids is actively toxic and dangerous. In the past, it was boring. Now it's harmful. So it's gone from dissociation to outright abuse. Well, that's just the way of things. So it's in the power structure's interests that you stay a child. And the way that you stay a child is by following ideology, which puts the blame. It puts the blame for your adulthood on your perceived enemies, thus rendering you impotent and helpless. Other people are in charge of your entire destiny. So it does that, but it also makes your enemies 100% responsible for their childhoods. Like you must be punished for being born into the bourgeoisie, even though, or being born among the capitalist class, you must be punished for that even as a child, although that's obviously not your fault. So your enemies are responsible even for their childhoods. You are not responsible even for your adulthood. And this is the demonic lure of ideology, that it offers you a state of perpetual childhood, which, if you had bad parents, is helplessness and resentment, rage. I'm not in control. Bad things are happening. I'm not in control. Bad things are happening. There are sinister forces far larger than me that are going to prevent me from having any chance of success. And that's a real amniotic sac that's dangled in front of people. You never have to grow up. You never have to grow up. You never have to grow up. Be helpless, be resentful. That protects your parents, that protects your teachers, that protects authority figures of every kind, and it protects you from responsibility, right? I mean, the purpose of parenting is to start with children who have no responsibility and end up graduating them to adulthood where they have 100% responsibility, right? You add on, you know, like when you're working out, you start off with light weights and then you add on weights. And so the purpose of parenting is to take children who have legit 0% responsibility and adding bits of responsibility so that they become adults who take responsibility. Because without responsibility, they can't have identity, achievement, happiness, success. They can't have love. Because if you're not responsible, you can't be virtuous. I mean, you can't call yourself a good, like, I'm an excellent money manager and an excellent entrepreneur because some unknown great aunt left me $1 million. Look at that. I've earned it. No, I mean, just accident, right? You can be admired for your financial and business acumen if you make $1 million, but not if you just inherit it from some great aunt you never even knew. Actually happened to a friend of mine once. He inherited a lot of money from some great aunt in another country he never really knew. But nobody's going to call him an excellent manager. So if you're not responsible for things, you can't be admired for them. If you can't be admired, you can't be loved. So when you give up self-ownership and you give up responsibility, you give up love. And you give up pride, achievement, and self-satisfaction, and meaning, and all of that stuff, right? So, and this is why, you know, I keep hammering in this show, 150% self-ownership. I myself, because everybody has that desire, I think, to not take self-ownership, I have to aim for 150% just to try and get to 100. To overcome the undertow or the drag of not wanting to take responsibility. It wasn't me, right? And of course, also, when you get punished for taking responsibility, you should get rewarded for taking responsibility, not punished. But parents and teachers in general punish you for taking responsibility, right? The glass breaks in the kitchen, your mom comes storming in, who broke it? Oh, it wasn't me, right? Because you know that if you say, I did, that you'll get punished, right? So you punish self-ownership, and that leads children down the dark path towards ideology. Now, with regards to feminism, it follows the same pattern, of course, which is the feminist is told that men are not responsible for being born men, of course, but they must still be blamed for it. That the man's mindset is conditioned by the patriarchy, but he's still 100% responsible for his mindset. So men are 100% responsible for their mindset, women are not. So it's giving women eternal adolescence. Well, see, women don't want eternal childhood. They want eternal 18, right? Because if women were to pursue eternal childhood, then they would not have access to sexual power. So they have to be eternal late teens. So women want more. I mean, this is basic hypergamy 101, that women want to date up, they want to marry up, they want the very best. And that's beautiful. And people get mad at that. It's like, you know, that's why we have the brains to talk about it, right? Is that women wanted more and more intelligent men to the point where we broke through the bicameral mindset and got language and concepts. So women's hypergamy is why we have the word hypergamy, right? So women's hypergamy wanting more and better is why we have more and better. It's why we're not animals living in trees. Right? Women wanted comfort. They wanted shelter. They wanted fire. They wanted, and women wanted language because it's tough to nag by shaking a banana, right? So I'm just kidding, right? But yeah, so we have all of these great things because women want more. Now, wanting more is great, but you have to be limited by objectivity, right? I've always loved singing. I don't know if I'd love to be a singer, but it would be a pretty cool thing. But I don't have the voice to be a singer, even though I've taken lessons and blah, blah, blah. I just don't have the voice for it. So I don't do that, right? I don't do that. I was scouted as a model when I was in my teens, but I decided not to go down that route for a variety of reasons, one of which was I've got some fairly prominent front teeth. I could see that I was probably going to lose my hair, so it probably wouldn't be great to get into modeling because then it's all about Sean Connery hair pieces or whatever, right? So I decided not to go down that route with some, you know, some disappointment and bitterness. I get that, but that is the reality. So for women wanting more, I deserve the best, if it's detached from reality, becomes incredibly destructive and delusional, right? So there's three words that feminism scrubs from women's vocabulary. I can get, right? So I want the best. Yes, of course. I want the best I can get. I want the best I can get. That's important, right? I want the best salary. Well, what's the best salary? A gazillion dollars a year? I want the best salary. No, no, no. I want the best salary I can get. And what you can get, the limitation of vanity, is the free market. The limitation of vanity is the free market. I want the best salary I can get that other people are willing to offer me. That other people are willing to offer me. Right? So in the great deplatforming of moi, I found out that, you know, 19 out of 20 people didn't value what I did enough to go to a new website. Now, that's not just that. Of course, you know, when I started giving up on politics, but partly why I gave up on politics was the lack of people following me. So when I found out how little investment people had in my work, I found that it was disappointing to some degree, but also I had very mixed emotions, right? It was disappointing, but I try not to be disappointed in facts. I try not to be disappointed in facts, right? And so it was disappointing, but it was also liberating because then I can work on what I feel is the most important for the future rather than what people tell me is the most important for the present, which is I prefer working in philosophy than in politics. So that was very liberating for me and kind of important to understand. So I want the biggest audience. Of course, I mean, who doesn't want a big audience? But I want the biggest audience I can get. I want the biggest audience I can get. And so for women, the limitation is, yeah, well, of course, everybody wants the best man, right? Everybody wants the alpha. Everybody wants the top, like all the women want the top tier guy. Yeah, okay. I want the very best man. I want to have the highest standards that I can get. And societies that have progressed have been societies that strongly discourage women from using sex to pretend they can get more than they can get. So the man a woman can get is not the man who will sleep with her. The man a woman can get is the man who will marry her. We've talked about this before. This is sort of the alpha widow phenomenon, that women in their 20s will offer sex to men, and therefore the highest tier men will sleep with them, but won't marry them, won't commit to them, won't become their boyfriends. But what happens is, by aiming too high and subsidizing with sex, you know, it's like these businesses that get massive subsidies and they aren't real businesses because they're getting all these massive subsidies and all it is destroying capital rather than building it. So by subsidizing interactions with men with sex, women end up thinking that they can do better than they can do. And then they end up in a much worse situation than when they started. So a woman from 20 to 30 who sleeps with a lot of guys who are top tier, and by top tier, I don't necessarily mean morally, I just mean attractive, relatively successful, enthusiastic, charismatic men or whatever. So she sleeps with a lot of those men. And one of the reasons why it's very hard for women to come to terms with that is that I would say they ended up in the hole. That's a bit on the nose, which is two holes. But the men they could have gotten when they were 20, they can't get at 30. So the subsidies have ended up with them in a worse situation. Sexuality, like hypersexuality to transitory relationships, is like cocaine to happiness, right? You get happiness and then you get absolute misery, right? You get happiness and then you get, I don't know, a destroyed septum or, you know, massive problems with your entire physical system because of the drug, right? It's like heroin. Here's your happiness and pay me later, right? And so women do get to interact with top-tier men by subsidizing the interactions with sex. And then what happens is they attune themselves or they attune their expectations to top-tier men. And then they try to lock in a top-tier man in their 30s, which ain't going to happen. And then they have to keep adjusting their expectations downward to the point where they feel like they're settling. They feel gross and they're not satisfied. And this is where a lot of these, you know, alpha widow divorces come from. Alpha Fs, beta bucks, right? So what feminism does is it says to women, you deserve the best without adding that you can get. Now for men, and this is another reason why sports is no longer as encouraged as it used to be. Because for men in particular, we want to be on the best sports team that will have us, right? So you've got this whole ritual in the playground, which is you pair up and then there are two team captains, you pair off, there are two team captains and they choose who they want to play on their team. And that's how you have some sense of where you stand in the hierarchy. Learning where you stand in the hierarchy is really, really important in life. Of course, we all want to be at the top tier hierarchy. We all want to be at the top, but we need, but not everyone can be at the top, right? The vast majority of people are not going to be at the top. So learning where you stand in the pecking order is absolutely essential for combating vanity. The vanity will say, and I have no problem with vanity, right? But it has to be tempered by reality. The vanity will say, I'm the greatest. I'm the greatest baseball player in the universe. But then if you're picked around the middle of people who are choosing you for their baseball team, that's kind of important. That's kind of important. And knowing that is essential. Knowing where you stand in the pecking order is essential because if you aim too high, you get nothing. If you aim too low, you get too little. If you aim too high, you get nothing, right? So if you're a guy who can be paid $80,000 a year, if you negotiate well and you know, do the right job in the interviews, you can get 80 grand a year. Now, if you say, I want $200,000 a year, you end up with nothing. If you take a job for 40 grand a year, you get less, but at least it's still something. So aim too high and you get nothing. Aim too low and you get less. And we want to find that sweet spot, which, by the way, of course, doesn't exist. It doesn't exist, right? What's the ideal salary? It doesn't exist. Everything's a negotiation. Everything's a compromise. So feminism takes women's natural hypergamy and removes the negative consequences or hides the negative consequences from them. And so this is why all the women are saying, well, I'm a 10 and I deserve the best and here's my list and 666, right? Six pack, 6 foot, six figures, right? I deserve the best. And it's like, well, no, you deserve what you can get. Now, of course, the consequences for women of not settling, right? You want hypergamy and you want settling, right? You want hypergamy and you want settling. And everybody settles. You say, well, Elon Musk is the richest guy in the world. I wouldn't want his life. I wouldn't want to work that kind of way. I wouldn't want to be, I assume, that distant from my kids. I wouldn't want to have all these kids by all these different women. I wouldn't want to not be in a monogamous relationship with my wife. So you'd have more money, but money can't buy you love, right? I didn't actually really believe that song when I was a kid. It's like, diamond ring, I could sell that and buy candy. I love candy. Money can buy you love. Basic equation. I get that now when you're older. It doesn't, right? So a way that you cripple people is you take away the empirical judgment of their value, right? So, and the way you do this, of course, is through law as well. If you say to employers, you must hire women or you're breaking the law, right? You must hire women or you're breaking the law. You must pay them X, Y, or Z or you're breaking the law. Then women don't have to say to themselves, what's better for me materially? Is it better for me materially to get a job or is it better for me materially to marry a successful man and have children. Now, I think, in general, if women's wages were in the free market, they would be lower in the workplace, and therefore the value of having children and or being married and supporting a man and having children, the value of that would go up. So preferential economic legislation for women is bribing them to not have children. It's part of the whole Depop agenda, which we sort of talked about before. So in the past, of course, if a woman didn't get married and have children, if she was a leftover woman, as they call women unmarried and with no prospects over 27 in China, if women are leftovers, they have to rely on the charity of strangers or of people who they're not particularly close to and certainly not that they're married to. There's a sort of chilling description from Amanda Wingfield in The Glass Menagerie of her fears for her daughter in the future, right? Amanda, the woman crippled by, my assumption is, sexual abuse by the father who fled. But the daughter, Lara, who's crippled intellectually, and the woman actually, it was really, really terrible. Tennessee Williams, his sister, he was a famous playwright, Night of the Iguana and Streetcar Named Desire, Glass Menagerie. His sister, they tried to fix her shyness with a lobotomy. The lobotomy was botched, and she ended up living for decade after decade at an institution, I assume mentally crippled by savagery, and died in the 90s. It was appalling. I think 1942, she had this botched lobotomy, and then she lived for another, over 50 years. It was just absolutely appalling what happened to her. But her mother is like, well, if you don't get married, she says, you know, I've seen these charity spinster cases all over the place in the South. Barely tolerated women tucked away in some attic in some resentful husband's house, barely coming out to take tea. And right, it's an appalling thing what happens to women in the past who didn't get married. Or I guess in this case, she ends up being lobotomized and locked away in an institution for 50 years of barely coherent, half-brain-dead misery. So there's no progress without consequences. There's no game without a downside. And because women can get financial support from the government and emotional support from other spinsters, the downsides, and of course, because the consequences are hidden from them, the downsides of taking the risk of aiming too high don't exist, right? You have to settle. And that's how you know someone's an addict, right? So the gambler is an addict when he loses everything because he keeps trying to get more and more and more and ends up with nothing. Well, it's the same thing with women and hypergamy released from economic and social consequences. They keep aiming for more and more until they end up with nothing. And then they blame the system, right? They blame the patriarchy. They blame the men, right? And so ideology both produces failures and then sells exoneration from failure to the failures that it has produced. So ideology says to women, you don't need a man, and the woman ends up lonely and bitter, and then ideology has to sell determinism to her life so she doesn't look in the mirror and say, I'm responsible for this catastrophe. I'm responsible for the catastrophe that is my life. And in a way, if you can tempt people into bad enough decisions, their capacity to take responsibility almost completely vanishes. Right? So it's one thing to say, I'm responsible when you can fix it. But it's very hard, if not downright impossible, to say, I'm responsible when you can't fix it. Right? I mean, you've heard this a million times with people in this show who had abusive parents, who've gone to talk to them, and the parents won't admit any fault, any responsibility. I can remember one mother who called in over thousands of shows or thousands of conversations. So if you can, this is like the devil, right? If he can lure you step by step into hell, there's no exit anymore. So if people can say you should follow your pleasure and your delusion and your vanity, and then like a woman who sails past 40, she can't have kids. Really? I mean, again, rare exceptions, past 50 or whatever cutoff you want to put, she can't have kids. And so is she going to say, I've messed up for the past quarter century, let's say she's in 18 to 43, I've messed up for the last quarter century, I succumbed to vanity and greed and delusion, and I've lost everything that would make the second half of my life even remotely happy, right? So 20 to 40, 40 to 80, right? So you mess up from 20 to 40, then you've got 40 to 80 to be miserable, and people can't handle that. They can't handle that, particularly if they're private people. Maybe publicly you could find a way to, I don't know, warn other people of your mistakes, but that doesn't really happen. And of course, nobody's in the mainstream media would ever publish those mistakes, which is why you don't see spinster regret anywhere in traditional media, right? It's not. I have it, of course, in my novel, The Present, which you should definitely check out at freedomain.com/books. It's free. But when people have made enough mistakes, they cannot accept responsibility, because you can't spend 40 years blaming yourself for a destroyed life. Like, say, 43 to 83 or whatever, right? For a woman, right? You can't spend 40 years, or it could be 50 years, 43 to 93. You can't spend all of that time waking up every morning, looking in the mirror and saying, I completely destroyed the second half of my life through greed and vanity. I spent 20 years building an edifice to 40 years of misery. Can't do that. So then ideology, which has blinded you to consequences, now comes in and says, oh, honey, it's not you, it's the system. It's patriarchy, it's the men. And that burden of self-recrimination gets lifted off the shoulders of people who've messed up their lives based on ideology. Ideology then comes along after making the wound and gives the painkiller. And the painkiller is, I'm not responsible. I didn't make choices. I didn't choose to reject a good guy. I'm a victim of the patriarchy. I'm a victim of the system. I'm a victim of men's greed and vanity. I mean, I remember there was a woman who called into, that radio, Tom Likas, radio show host from California in the 90s, I think it was. He's still, I think, doing stuff online, but a woman would call in and she said, you know, like, I'm 50, I'm well-read, and, you know, I just want a real quality guy. And Tom Likas was like, nope. Like, she says, I own my own house. I've got some savings. And he's like, men don't care that you have your own house. Men don't care that you have your own house. Men don't care that you have money. I mean, you want a successful man, he's got his own money. You want a single successful man, roughly in your own age group, but maybe he wants kids. He probably does, in which case he's going to go for a woman who's 30. He doesn't care. He's got money. He doesn't need your money. He doesn't care that you own your own house. And so what she was doing was the sort of fundamental mistake that women and men do, which is to imagine that what they find attractive in the opposite sex is what the opposite sex finds attractive in them. So she wants a guy with money, with property, with financial success. And she says, well, I have money, I have property, I have financial success. And she doesn't realize, of course, that that's not what men are looking for, particularly the successful men. Maybe some loser guy who wants a sugar mommy might want that, but not the men that she wants. So I hope this helps with regards to looking at ideology. I really appreciate the questions. As always, keep them coming, freedomain.locals.com. And don't forget, if you want to call in, you can email me, callin@freedomain.com, and we will talk. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Thanks a mil. Bye.